When it comes to home repairs, we could all use a guy. Well, we've got the guy, and we've got the show. For all your home improvement questions, we've got answers. This is the Fix-It Show on WTMJ. Presented by J&B Construction and Siding Unlimited. Now, here's your host, Dayton Kane and David Nason.
Another Saturday, another chance to sit down and talk fixing stuff on your house. Dayton Kane and David Nason, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. How was your week?
My week was pretty good. Busy again. I had some meetings. Did some mediation things. I belong to the
Mary. You and you're mediating.
Yeah, and arbitrations, that kind of stuff.
That's so. Becoming a bigger part of your business, it seems.
Yeah, along with the consulting work. Yes, it is.
Okay, so tell people how you got started in this. What, you're an inspector, a home inspector.
Right. So going, I guess, way back, I graduated from the School of Architecture, UWM, and decided I didn't really want to be an architect at that point. Got into construction. And so I worked in remodeling, design, build, remodeling. Swung a hammer for almost 2 years and decided that it gets cold in the winter and I didn't like being outside as a carpenter. But really wanted to get into doing more design work and managing projects. So I did that. Total probably 11 years or so in design, build, remodeling work. And then I got into other things. I worked for Pella Windows when it was Verhalen. Did that for a little while. I worked for Burmeister Woodwork. I worked for Kelman Restoration. So I got into fire and water restoration work. Did that for about 8 years. I worked for a commercial contractor in McGonigal for almost 5 years, building bigger buildings, and as a project or a site superintendent for that. So I'd say a good amount of construction background that, and you know, for a while I was trying to decide, okay, which way I'm going. I had a number of jobs. Later realized that now that all those jobs I was doing have really trained me for what I'm doing. So in about 2013, got interested in home inspections and eventually was able to team up with Tom Faza, the original host of this show, Mr. Fix-It. And very fortunate, very blessed to be able to work with him for about 6 years prior to his retiring, where I, like I said, I had quite a bit of construction background, but Tom really taught me how to be an inspector, really to what to look for, how to do inspecting things. And so got a lot of referrals, got me pretty well known in the industry, got me introduced to attorneys and other things, where now I'm doing a fair amount of consulting work, helping people who are having problems with their contractor if they're having issues. I went and got certified to be an EIFS inspector and a stone veneer inspector. So those are specialty exterior claddings that you probably run into a fair amount with the work that you do as well. And so I do inspections of those things. And like any cladding, most claddings aren't considered to be 100% waterproof, like especially vinyl siding. It has drain holes in it and things like that. But some of these other products, it's a bigger issue if water gets behind them and can cause damage. So I'm certified in inspecting EIFS and stone veneer. And I also, as you mentioned, I'm an inspector. I do home inspections, primarily home inspections. Every once in a while, I'll do a smaller commercial building. I don't get into big high rises or large multi-tenant type buildings or things like that. But a single tenant, small building, fairly simple construction, probably has mechanicals that are similar to a home. I can definitely do that kind of inspection. So, and then in 2025, when Tom decided to hang up his headphones from the Fix-It Show, I took over his role here in the Fix-It Show. You joined me about a year later here, and here we are today.
Yeah, and you are the president of WAHI.
Yes, the Wisconsin Association of Home Inspectors. So I was first elected in 2024. I'm in my second term here.
So
no, actually, I think sooner than that. I'm
very involved.
Time's flying by.
Very involved in everything. That's why you're on the show. You're an expert. Right. You've done it all. You've been in a lot of different places. You've seen a lot of different things.
Right.
And you know how to fix it.
Right.
So bestinspectionsllc.com is your website, right, if people want to reach out to you and get them out for a home inspection. But good. We haven't reset in a while why you're the host of this show, so that's a good background. We'll be back. More of the Fix It Show on WTMJ.
The Fix It Show with Dayton Kane and David Nason on WTMJ.
Thank you for listening to The Fix It Show on WTMJ. Dayton Kane, David Nason. You can always find The Fix It Show podcast on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcast. So we're going into Thanksgiving week here, David.
Right.
Middle of November, approaching the end of November.
Right.
Can we still be doing stuff on the outside of the house at this time?
Well, obviously, weather is going to be the biggest factor with that. But you should be able to do some projects still. Painting and caulking, likely not.
What temperature do you need? 40s?
40s, yeah. I think Matt Hefter has always said there's some paints that will cure down into the upper 30s. I can't remember for sure. The Sherwin-Williams or Holman Lindsay paints might be able to hide some high-performance coatings. Could probably do that, but for the most part, you're probably done painting and caulking on the outside. If you had to do something like that, you might have to create a little bit of a tent or something, or only work on the south side of your home where if it's sunny, you're going to get some warmth, kind of thing. But otherwise, carpentry projects, if you needed to repair some siding, or let's say there's some wood trim, if your house has cedar siding on it or something, or another type of siding, but you have cedar trim, that type of work you could definitely do. I think if you ask most siding contractors or carpenters, October, November is like an ideal time for them to be working outside.
Yeah.
It's a little cool, crisp in the morning, but once you get going and working, absolutely great time. Yeah, you're not getting too hot. You got to have a sweatshirt on. And like maybe in the morning, you got a light pair of gloves. But once you get going and get the blood moving, it's perfect. So get out and take a look at what's going on with the outside of your house before we get really into winter. And you can't do anything really, and everything freezes. So like I said, replacing some trim, grading around your house. We talk about gutters, gratings, and downspouts, right, all the time. When all the plantings and flowers around your house have now gone dormant, now you can really get a good look and see what the ground around your house is.
Sure.
So rake the mulch back, rake the rocks back, whatever you have around your house. Check to see if the dirt is sloped towards your house. You know, we had that huge flood in August. A lot of people got water in their basement. We've talked about this with Chris and Jeff regarding foundations. So much foundation problem, basement problems is all about water getting in. And when you got water in your basement, you've never had it in there before. Now that water has found a path, and so now you want to stop that path. And so rake all that stuff back, get some dirt in there, get that. Don't compact it. You don't want to turn your dirt into like your clay into like concrete around your house. But get it in there and then put your mulch and everything back. Get that all situated so that come next spring, after all the snow melts and everything, you got a good place for water to run away. So the grading around your house, also check your downspouts, make sure they're attached.
Yeah, we're still in that time of year when you can get rain, but then you're going to get the snow, and that's going to melt, and you want that to go the right place. So make sure that everything's connected the way it should be.
Right.
I'm amazed how many times I'll walk around a house and see downspouts that are hanging there not connected to the gutter, or the big downspout extension is not connected to the downspout itself. Those are easy fixes,
absolutely,
and that gets that water away from the house. So
most people know that they need to clean out their gutters, but somebody pointed this out to me. I can't remember who to give credit to, but if you look at your downspouts, and right below the gutter, there's an elbow, and a little section goes back to the house, and there's another elbow. If you see stains at those connections where those elbows are, there's a good chance that your downspout or those elbows are clogged.
Yeah.
And now the water is leaking out right there instead of getting down the downspout. So don't just think, oh, I cleaned out my gutters, I'm all good.
Right.
If you're seeing staining on the outside of your downspouts, or here's another thing, if you have underground downspouts, you know, where they come down and they go underground, if you look at that vertical downspout along the wall, if you look on the back and there's the aluminum gutter is basically a piece of aluminum and they bent it and there's a seam on the back. If that's popped open in the back, that means that that downspout underground, there's a good chance it gets clogged in the winter or is clogged, and now it's filled with water and it freezes, and that water, when it freezes, it expands and busts that seam open.
Yeah. So and still some things we can do outside at this time of year that we want to make sure we tackle. So.
Right.
It is a Fix-It show. Thank you. If you have calls or texts, 855-616-1620. Dayton Kane and David Nason on WTMJ.
WTMJ's The Fix-It Show with David Nason and Dayton Kane.
Welcome back, Dayton Kane and David Nason. 855-616-1620 is the Siding Unlimited WTMJ talk and text line. We were talking about drainage before. Somebody texted in and said, I want to check my sump pump, but it's covered and sealed. How do I do that?
Right. So many sump crocks, sump pumps are sealed today. Newer homes for sure are, and probably been doing it for a little while. But anyways.
And that's because of the radon system?
Well, maybe not.
Okay. So why
yes
would
or no.
we do
not
that?
Not all new houses have radon systems in them, but I believe they're doing that just to try to minimize or limit the amount of
radon that
air that's coming out of that
gotcha.
Crock, which is a good thing. But if that's the case, and when I am doing an inspection and I come across that a crock like that, so there's really two options when I see that. The pump that's in there has one cord coming out of the crock, mm-hmm. and it's sealed around it, and it's plugged in. There's really no way to test that one. If there's two cords coming out, one's plugged into the back of the first one, that one you can pull those two plugs apart, and then the plug in the back, plug that into the outlet.
Oh.
That one's for the pump. The one in front that has it's a longer plug. It plugs in, and then the pump plugs into the back of it. That one's connected to the float that's in there. So when the float reaches the height where the water comes up, it'll kick on the switch in the plug and provide power to the pump and
gotcha.
The pump pumps. So you can bypass that, test your pump by doing that, take them apart and plug in your pump. If you don't have the two cords coming out and you just got the one coming in, really the only way that I tell people is that you got to create a resealable access into that. You can undo all the bolts. It's usually... if you don't have a radon system, it's just bolts and a rubber gasket. You can do it. It's a bunch of work. I always say, well, let's make a port that's resealable that you can do this every once in a while. That way you can, if you make it big enough, 3-4 inches, maybe you can stick your arm in there, lift the float. But I like the idea better that now that gives you an opportunity to pour water in the crock.
Sure.
Because just by lifting the float and even doing the bypass isn't a 100% guarantee that the pump is actually functioning. It's making noise.
Right.
You know, but is it pumping water? And so filling the crock with water enough, get a bucket, you go over to your utility sink, and pour enough water in there to make it work. That's going to be for sure. If you have a radon system, for sure that covers now is going to be caulked in place.
Yes.
Now it's going to be a little more difficult to get that off. And so if you're having a radon system installed, ask your radon contractor to put some kind of access port in that cover for you so that you can check that. You can pour water in there, lift the float, whatever you want to do. That just makes so much more sense.
How long does a sump pump typically last? Are we talking 4 years, 7 years, 10 years? Where should we be like, okay, yeah. I've had this long enough, I should probably swap it out.
Yeah, probably the most well-known one, pump manufacturer around here is Jim Murray Pumps up in Germantown. I believe their pumps are in the like 50,000 cycles. So you think, okay, I might be off on that number, but a lot. They're testing them a lot. But here's the thing. As with almost anything, it's the environment that it's in. If it's sitting down there in just a little bit of water and it's sealed and it doesn't run much, you just get a little water trickling in enough, you know, every once in a while, but mm-hmm. then it evaporates or the radon system kind of sucks that humidity out, it's probably going to just get all rusty and corroded. So things like that do need to work. They need to run every once in a while. This is why I say pour some water in there and make it work. So, but I personally, if I don't have one in my house. I have an old house. I don't have one. If I had one, I would probably be making sure that it every 6 months or so that it was working. But I'd probably figure on replacing it like every 4 to 5 years.
It is a Fix-It show. Got another half hour to go this hour and no guests next hour either. So get your calls and texts in at 855-616-1620. Thanks for listening to WTMJ.
David and Dayton. One guy knows what the heck he's talking about. We'll let you figure out which one it is. It's the Fix-It show on WTMJ.
The Fix-It show on WTMJ. I'm Dayton. It's David. Thank you for listening this morning. We appreciate that. I know we're going into Thanksgiving weekend, and people are getting into that holiday spirit, and that means I want to light my fire and have a cozy environment. What should we be doing before we flip the switch on our gas or we throw a log in the fire?
Right. Well, let's start with wood-burning fireplaces. Everybody loves a snap, crackle, pop of a wood-burning fireplace. You really ought to be having that fireplace swept and inspected once a year. Now, if you only use it at Thanksgiving and Christmas, maybe not. Yeah. I mean, if that's what it's limited to, you could probably go a few years, really. But if you're using it frequently during the winter, you really ought to be doing a once-a-year cleaning inspection, especially if the older the fireplace is. If it's a masonry fireplace and it's got a clay flue tiles, you can't see the inside of that. I get that question a fair amount. When you do an inspection, what are you looking at in the fireplace? Well, I'll look in the firebox. I'll look to see if there's any cracks in the firebox and the bricks and mortar or such. See what the condition of the damper is. Can it open and close? Does it operate? Try to look up in there. Does it look dirty? Is there creosote all in there? And then if I'm on the roof, I'll try to look at the top of the chimney down in there as much. But the majority of that fireplace flue I cannot see. And so I always recommend with a house that has a wood-burning fireplace that they should get a level 2 inspection. Level 2 is the NFPA's, I think it's 211, their standard, is where the inspector runs a camera up the fireplace flue and looks at the condition of the flue. When we took your chimney down off your roof, that thing came apart so easily.
You know, and he did the camera, and what he found, even that flue was shot.
Yes.
So if I were to light a fire in that fireplace, it's getting into my attic. Yes. It's getting into my walls. Right. It's like that smoke isn't going out of my house.
Exactly. So with a wood burner, that's the concern. We don't want chimney fires or house fire or anything like that. So now many people have taken that masonry chimney and they've converted it to gas. They had a gas log system installed. And the gas logs don't create anywhere near the heat that a wood fire. Well, back to the wood fire. If you are making wood fire, start your fire small. Don't stack a whole bunch of paper, cardboard, a wood burner, starter, all this stuff, and get that thing roaring because you want a roaring fire in 2 minutes. You need to get it small because you need to heat that flue up slowly, especially if it's cold outside.
Sure.
If you get that cranking right away, that quick expansion contraction, that's what causes damage to chimneys. So you need to start a small fire.
And make sure your flue's open.
And yes, make sure the damper's open.
Yeah, the damper.
And you know, get the heat going up slowly so that you're not causing things can expand slowly and things. So, but with a gas fireplace, now we're concerned about combustion gas. We're burning gas, so we don't want, if you have cracks and things, you know, we don't want that CO to get into your attic, into your house. You know, you need to be going out the flue. The other thing, if it can't vent properly, burning gas creates more condensation, especially when it's cold. You get condensation on the inside of the flue tiles. That freezes. Now you get cracks and things. So it's all back to making sure you have these things checked and inspected. There are different types of gas logs. Some will have a standing pilot where then all you do is turn a small knob on the side. Some you have to turn it and light it with a lighter, or there might be a key on the floor, like an access. When I say a key, it's about the size of it's bigger than a key, but you turn a gas valve.
To turn the gas line on.
To gas on. Yeah. And I always tell people, I'm demonstrating this, and it's like, get your lighter, get set here and everything, stand a little bit off to the side, open the gas valve a little bit, or have your lighter lit, and then start opening the gas. If you do it the opposite, where you turn the gas on, and then, where's my lighter, and everything, you're looking for your lighter, and then you light it, boom, you're going to lose your eyebrows.
I've seen people do that with their grills.
Grills, too.
Where do they do that? Yeah.
So get your lighter lit, turn on the gas, and then you got it. And then the third type really is the direct vent type, where it's completely sealed. And those are you either turn a switch, you know, flip a switch on the wall, and it comes on. It could either be a standing pilot or an electronic ignition. You can't open it or anything. They're much more like a furnace, but they give off a lot of heat. They do need to be serviced. If you get this white haze on the inside of the glass, that's very common. Don't think that it's broken or anything. That happens to all of them. You just need to have it clean, so you should call a gas fireplace contractor.
The text that came in to 855-616-1620 says, I have a gas fireplace. I used to be able to just flip the switch on my wall and it would turn on. It's not turning on. What should I be looking at?
Well, there's a good chance that those type of fireplaces, they have a vent that goes out the back of the wall. Sometimes they go through a chimney, but usually goes out. There might be a blockage in that pipe, in that vent. And if these have a safety feature on them, just like a furnace does. If it can't get enough air to burn oxygen, fire needs oxygen. Mm. If it can't get enough air, it won't start or it'll go out. So I've had them where I've started them, and about a minute later, it turns off, and I try to restart it, and it won't start. So that means there's something in the system. The fireplace has determined I can't turn on because I have a problem. You know, it's a little computer in it. So that's time for a service.
All right, we need to take another break. When we come back, more of your calls and texts. It is the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
David Nason and Dayton Kane. It's the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
855-616-1620 is a WTMJ Siding Unlimited talk and text line. And a text came in during the break that says, when you're doing inspections, do you run into a lot of mouse droppings? Sounds like somebody's got an issue they
right.
want to know about.
Asking for a friend?
Yeah, asking for a friend.
Right. So sometimes. Not a lot in kitchen. Sometimes you see them in the kitchen cabinet under the sink or something. It seems like they follow the pipes holes in those cabinets where the pipes come up and everything. So sometimes we see them there. Probably where I see them the most is in your attic. And the reality is that more than half easily and probably closer to 60 or 70% of attics.
Really? That
many? Yeah. It's where if you haven't been in your attic ever, which is understandable, most homes today, that attic is not meant for storage or anything.
Right.
Get a little steps ladder and everything, pop the attic hatch open and just with a flashlight, and you don't have to go crawling around your attic. And trust me, you will not see live mice. In 13 years, I have not seen a live mouse in an attic.
Really?
As soon as you start, you got to think, they are so much more afraid of you than I am of them.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not afraid necessarily of mice. They might surprise you if you saw one you didn't expect. But if I'm lifting that attic hatch up, making noise, they're gone. They're over other end of the attic or corner or something. Pop that up. Look around. If you see little tunnels in the insulation, if you have fiberglass insulation, pink or white, or if you have drawn a blank.
Cellulose?
Cellulose, which is basically shredded papers and sometimes shredded blue jeans sometimes. But you can see these tunnels in the insulation, or if you look at the top of the insulation, it looks like little mountains, kind of, they're only 3 or 4 inches tall or anything, and it looks like trails. Those are trails.
Sure.
From the mice. So it's hard to evaluate to what extent they are up there, because again, I'm not seeing them, not really hearing them. But every once in a while, I'll see one where it's like, wow, there's a mess up there.
I can tell you, every house I've ever owned, I catch mice in.
Yeah.
I just, no matter what I do, if I try sealing stuff, they can get in.
Right.
They get in.
The first thing, if you call a pest management company, the first thing they're going to look at is the vegetation around your house. Trees, bushes, anything that's up against your house or close to your house and everything, overhanging, these become ladders.
Yeah.
These pests, mice, we're talking about getting in your attic, but we still don't want squirrels and raccoons and things up on your roof. I mean, I see evidence of that every once in a while, their droppings and things up on a roof. But so in an attic, I mean, and you can't just put up poison, you know, open the hatch and drop some poison and put a trap and think that you're going to take care of it.
Because then they're going to die up there.
Well, no,
stink. No,
you got a whole big attic. True, I mean, you're just putting them right here, and mice are very prolific at making more mice. And so you, as you said, they get in. You have to see where they're getting in, and you have to stop where they're getting. Yeah. So really, it's a pest management company. They need to come back multiple times to make sure they're getting everywhere, locked up.
What about bats? You ever run across those?
I have seen one live bat in my time. He was stuck between insulation and a plastic vapor barrier on a gable wall. And I kind of went up to it and I touched the plastic and he moved a little bit. I do see bat droppings every once in a while. And the difference, you can tell very easily that mouse droppings are like a little seed. Yeah. They're pretty small. Bat droppings are about 3/16 inch long, about an eighth inch, like a really dried up raisin.
Okay.
Basically. Huh. If you're seeing those, there's a good chance you have bats.
Oh, pest control minute here on the Fix-It Show. 855-616-1620 if you want to text in with your questions. Dayton Kane and David Nason here with you. Thanks for listening to WTMJ.
Get her done. It's the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
Believe it or not, we're already getting towards the end of November, November 22nd. Dayton Kane and David Nason here. Thank you for listening. The seasons are a-changing, David.
Yes, they are.
Gets to a point where certain things can't be done on the outside of a house. One of those things is actually putting on a stone veneer that's actually mortared.
Right.
It gets to a point where it's too cold and you can't do that. It suddenly becomes a spring project. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier when we were talking about what you do, you're an inspector on those now, and you've been certified in stone veneers. There's a couple of different kinds.
Right.
Which one are you seeing more often and what's the difference and why are we looking at different options?
So there are a couple brands that are installed very similar to siding. They have a nailing hem on the top where they basically have a groove and they sit on the row below it. It has a starter channel at the bottom that it clips into, and then the next one, then they just kind of they're put in like siding basically, but it looks like stone. And you screw it into they're generally installed with screws, not nails.
Right.
And so that's, I don't inspect that kind.
Okay.
The type I is what you mentioned is the type that's mortared, and we call that an adhered stone veneer. So, stone veneer or brick veneer or veneer really is just an extra cladding that's generally masonry. And in carpentry, we see veneers, you got a wood veneer or something.
Sure.
So it's something that's put on the surface of something behind it. And the adhered stone veneer is applied to a wall and it's not supported by a brick or a stone ledge. So it's literally stuck to the wall. Some home inspectors, I don't like the term, but they call it lick and stick type stone, or faux stone, you may have heard or something. So it actually is installed more similarly to the really old original type of stucco.
Yeah, okay.
Stucco. So where you put up a weather barrier on the wall, and behind stone veneer, you have to have at least two layers of a weather-resistant barrier, or what we call WRB. So on your house, you're going to have a house wrap, Tyvek, Greenspan, something behind the siding. And then behind the stone, we have to have an additional layer. And usually they'll run that house wrap down, and then they put like a 30-pound building or roofing felt behind it. And then after that's installed, then they have to nail or staple onto the wall a metal lath. And so this is, I guess, the best if you're trying to picture a metal lath with chicken wire. But it's a lot tighter of a mesh of material. And it has to be a galvanized product. And then you have to install that in a certain direction. It is a directional product. So they put that on. And then there's certain flashings that have to be put on, a weep screed at the bottom of the wall, a sill flashing if there's a stone sill flashing, and then a scratch coat where they, similar to stucco, they trowel on a coat of mortar, and that's supposed to embed the mesh into that first scratch coat of mortar. So now you let that cure, and then you basically put trowel on the mortar on the back of the stones, and you stick it onto this, and that's where the stick kind of name kind of comes from. And so this product, when it was first came out, it's been around 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. It's been around a long time. It's a great product. And with anything else, it needs to be installed correctly. When it first came out, I would say just in general, the water wasn't being managed properly. This is one of these other products, just similar to the EFIS systems, like the synthetic stucco systems, where it was initially thought that, well, we'll just keep the water out. Well, when water gets behind a product like this where it's adhered to the house, it has to have a way to get out.
Right.
And when before they started installing these drainage plane systems, it didn't have a way to get out, and that's why we have damage. So
is that a lot of what you're inspecting and looking for when you're at that?
Right. And I would say the vast majority of the installations, there's a few details that are almost never done. And I'm being very general here, but I'm seeing more and more do some things right. So when you have LP Smart Side or Hardy Plank Siding and you have a trim board and then you have stone up to it, the installation instructions for the stone veneer say that that should be a soft joint or a caulk.
Right.
And the Hardy Plank or the LP or Miratech, AZEK, whatever brand of trim you have there, in their installation instructions, their instructions say that it should not be in contact with concrete, masonry, or mortar. So there needs to be a sealant there, and almost nobody does that. I'm just being general about it. I've seen it a couple times,
right.
But really it doesn't. Is that the biggest deal? I don't think it's going to be a real source of moisture intrusion. What it is going to happen is that the mortar's not going to stick to the other product, the dissimilar material. You're going to see shrinkage cracks there.
Sure.
The biggest concern that I always have with that is where, say, for example, you have a two-story house and then a garage and the attached garage, and it turns 90 degrees. So that garage goes back. The roof intersects with the wall of the house, and you have a gutter and eave there. There's supposed to be a type of flashing there called kick-out flashing.
Mm-hmm.
The stone is supposed to be held up off the roof 2 inches and a weep screed there, and all that's got to be flashed in detail properly, and a lot of times it's not, and that is a funnel for water. It's just water is getting behind the stone there. If you see any, if you have stone in your house and you see a gutter there and everything, there's staining on the wall there, I have maybe some bad news for you. There's probably some water getting in the wall there if that stone and mortar is already stained. And so those are the places that I focus on when I'm doing my inspections. I do visual inspection, but I also do some probing with some of the moisture meters that I have when looking for water.
BestInspectionsLLC.com is David's website. That does it for hour number one. We'll be back for hour number two. Thanks for listening.
When it comes to home repairs, we could all use a guy. Well, we've got the guy, and we've got the show. For all your home improvement questions, we've got answers. This is the Fix-It Show on WTMJ, presented by J&B Construction and Siding Unlimited. Now, here's your host, Dayton Kane and David Nason.
Hour number two, thank you for tuning in. Dayton Kane, David Nason, talking fixing things. And at the beginning of the last hour, you actually said that you were in a mediation this week. What is that for people that don't know that term, and how are you involved in that?
Right. So mediations and arbitrations are ways to resolve disputes, complaints that we hear. I'm on the NARI Ethics and Bylaws Committee as a NARI member. And being on that it's a volunteer committee. So much like being the president of WAHI is a volunteer, is my way, I think, of giving back to our industry. And what we're trying to do with that in that committee is help people resolve complaints or disputes. I think a couple of shows back, Eric from Siding Unlimited talked about not being a perfect contractor, but it's how you handle and how you resolve those things. And
right.
So,
because nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect. So, and every once in a while, you know, lines of communication break down between owners, contractors, and things. And then we need a third party to step in. And NARI has a way of doing that with our bylaws committee, ethics and bylaws committee, and where we initially will talk to the homeowner, the consumer, talk to the contractor, try to figure out, okay, is this something we can just handle over the phone? So it's kind of really informal. And if that's like, you know what, I think we need to come out to your house. And so if I'm involved, myself, another member of our committee, we'll set up a time to go out to the house, the consumer's house, and see the project that the contractor did, and go through the issues that the homeowner is alleging. I mean, I'm saying alleging because at this point I haven't seen anything. And there's they always say there's three sides to every story: your side, my side, and the truth. So so we're going out and we're gonna try to look at things, hear both sides, and say, okay, what can happen here? And it really has to be a compromise. Both sides have to be willing to understand that you're going to have to give here. You're not going to get completely. You don't get everything you want. And if that's not acceptable, if we can't come to that resolution, that mediation where we hammer it out right there on site, and honestly, that, and we'll ask you to sign a piece of paper. Hey, you agreed to this. You agreed to this. That can just go flying away in the wind. It's not binding or anything. But if that fails, that mediation fails, we can't come to a resolution, the next step then is an arbitration. And an arbitration involves getting a judge through a random process. We get a pick from a handful of judges. And now we're at the NERI office and we're in a conference room and both sides are there. And this is, by the way, this is all confidential. When we become a member of this committee, we're asked to I think we have to sign something. I'm trying to remember. That basically we're going to remain confidential, that these cases are only discussed. I'm talking about them, but I'm not giving any details. We're only talking about these when we're in our committee meeting. It's a closed-door meeting. People can't just come in because we're discussing things like this. And so anyways, so the arbitration is where a judge comes in and hears both sides and gets information from both sides. It's not like court. The idea is that this is supposed to be less expensive than court. It's also handled quicker than court. If anybody has ever been in court, or even if you haven't been in court, good for you. But you see and hear about things on, you know, in the news, or something happens, and the court date is like 8 months out. It's like, wow, why is it taking so long? That's just our court system. So many things are backlogged. So in arbitration, we can usually get that hearing in a matter of a few weeks. We just have to pick a date that everybody can be there. And then the judge hears everything, and then he might consult with the NERI members who are there only to get information, not opinions. This is solely the judge's opinion.
Sure.
But he's going to get information from us about maybe some things that were said or maybe what we saw when we were out at the house. And then the judge will make us – now that's a binding decision. And that if one party fails on their part, the other party can take them to court I'm trying to blank, but basically force them to compel them. That's the word I was looking for. Compel them to do that work, what they agreed to. So that's the arbitration, mediation, arbitration process. This is all so important, makes it so much more important to make sure you pick a good contractor.
Yeah.
And I think we can get into that here.
Do your research a little bit. And it also, let's get into that when we come back.
Right.
It is a Fix-It show. 855-616-1620 if you want to participate. Thanks for listening.
Advice you can use. It's the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
We're back. Thank you for tuning in this morning. You mentioned as we were going into the break, picking a good contractor, somebody you can trust, somebody that's known. What's the process to find that? What would you suggest people do to figure that out?
Well, NERI is a good first source. You can go on their website. You can call and get a directory for NERI members. Being a NERI member isn't just about calling up the office and say, hey, I want to join. Can you send me an application? Here's my check. You actually have to be sponsored by somebody. So when I joined NERI, actually Scott Klein from J&B sponsored me, and I had to give referrals. I might have given you as a referral. I'd have to have had to have three referrals. I don't remember who I all used, but they had to be people in the trade somewhere, right, and that can speak for you as a company. Now, I'm not a traditional contractor member of NERI that like Siding Unlimited is or others, but I'm there as a member. I'm more to offer services to other NERI members, but you have you are vetted, so that's a good place to look for a member. Ask your neighbors and friends. Google reviews are important. I wouldn't rely completely on Google reviews 100% in the world of AI.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and especially, well, yeah, now that you bring that up.
Yeah.
If you go to Google reviews and there's 10 of them and it's a 5-star, that's different than going to another one that's got 400 and it's a 4.7-star.
Yeah.
The amount of people tuning in. But now you say AI. I wonder if you could work the system and just,
I don't know,
say create a bunch of Google reviews for me.
I would imagine Google.
You're scaring me now, David.
I would imagine Google's on top of that.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I have
260 some and almost all 5-stars. So, but anyways.
But do your research.
Do your research. Find out, you know. And then when you're talking, the NARI shows, these home shows, those are a good place to go and interview people. You get a feeling for who they are and everything. Ask some simple questions. You know, are you licensed? In Wisconsin, do you have the certifications for what you're doing, that kind of thing?
So when I show up, I provide our insurance certificate, our license to work, our Better Business Bureau rating, and then there's one other thing. But yes, that's the first step with me. Like, we are a contractor. We've been around 31 years. Here's all the things you would need to ask a contractor. Mm-hmm. So when they come, this isn't a given.
Right.
Make sure you're asking those questions.
And the reason that that license part is so important for two reasons. Number one, the only person who can take a permit to do work on your house that you live in is you, because you live in that house, and a licensed contractor. If you're hiring something, or you're talking about working with somebody, and they're like, and you ask them, do you need a permit for this? And, oh, yeah, can you go get that permit? That's a red flag.
Yeah, because that means they probably can't.
They can't. That puts all the liability of the project on you.
Because that's what a permit is, right?
Yes.
So you go to the permit office, you pull a permit, so that when the job is done, the inspector comes for that permit and makes sure everything was done to code.
Mm-hmm.
And if the contractor didn't pull the permit and they disappear— you're now responsible for getting that up to code.
Now, and also while the project's going on, you're responsible for – you're basically become a general contractor when you take the permit out. If you own a property, let's say I own a rental duplex property, I can't take a permit out for my rental duplex because I don't live there. That's part of the state law that says that you can't take that out. So it's very important to make sure you have a licensed contractor. The other thing with what you want to look for is a contract. You might say, oh, I don't, you know, fine print of a contract scares me, you know, all this. Might be a little overwhelming or something, but I would be more of afraid of a contractor who handed me a one-page contract that didn't have any kind of fine print, that didn't talk about anything other than what is happening. Because, as we said, you know, disputes happen, problems happen. The fine print is what addresses all that stuff, not just the project. Besides, the state of Wisconsin has a law called ATCP 110 that requires all that stuff to be in a contract. Right. It has, not only does it say what I'm replacing 10 windows and you're getting Marvin windows that are white and, you know, this size or whatever, it's, you want the specifications, but your contract should say when you're starting, when it's going to be finished. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that is required to be in that contract.
Never sign something if you don't know what it says.
Right.
We talked about that a couple of weeks ago where you thought you were just signing to get some financing options and you signed a contract. Don't make sure you're reading that. If somebody comes into your home in Wisconsin and they sell you something, you have three business days to cancel that contract. Legal. They have to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing to look for. But yes, contracts, permits, what are some big things that you know you have to get permits for?
Well, an addition on your home for sure.
If you're changing a size of an opening, window, adding a door.
Right. Anything structural.
Anything structural.
You got to put a new header in there. Yeah.
Electric.
Electrical permit. You know, if you're changing out outlets or switches, I don't think that.
But if you're changing the box.
But if you're changing the box, panel. If you're rewiring something, for sure, moving electrical in a house,
plumbing
as well. Mechanical stuff generally falls under a building permit. That when I say mechanical, that's HVAC stuff. Most municipalities, roofs, you need a permit for.
Just be aware.
Yeah, yeah. And you can find wherever you're living, go and look, find the city's webpage, village webpage, and it'll say go to the building inspection department, and there'll be something on there that tells whether or not permits required.
Good stuff. Got more coming up. 855-616-1620. The Fix It Show is on WTMJ.
Like a user's manual on the radio. It's the Fix It Show on WTMJ.
Dayton Kane and David Nason, thank you for hanging out with us today. We appreciate that. Every Saturday from 7 to 9, it's the Fix It Show, where we talk fixing things. And we did get a text at 855-616-1620. When you do your inspections, do you look for hazardous materials? That's a great question.
Yes, it is a good question. Short answer is no. Huh? But long answer is
no. So let me stop there. Legally, inspectors don't have to do it.
It's not in our home inspection standards. Okay. We are not required to comment on or inspect for hazardous materials.
Okay.
However, I am the type of inspector that if I see something, I say something. Having done this now for almost 13 years, you obviously get to know some things, and the training that I've gone through, the seminars that I attend and things, we kind of have a pretty good idea of what things look like. It's kind of that if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So asbestos is one of them, obviously. 9-inch by 9-inch vinyl tiles on your basement floor, if you have a 40s, 50s, 60s house, probably have asbestos in them. The glue that holds them down, the mastic, probably has asbestos. Probably one of the least dangerous. I'm not saying it's not dangerous at all, but asbestos needs to be friable in order for it to be dangerous. And friable, the definition of that is you take the product, you try to crush it in your fingers so that you could inhale it and get it into your lungs.
So when we had the flooding and we were scraping up our church basement, getting the carpet off, we hit tile underneath that, and we're cracking that all up, and I'm like, I guarantee we're all inhaling asbestos right now.
So I will point that out, and I'll say you need, if you're concerned about this, you know, some people are, whatever, you should have it tested. And you have to be certified by the state to do even take a sample and do a test for asbestos. So pipe wrap in an older house, you have a boiler, the pipes, the hot water pipes, they're usually wrapped in asbestos. There's types of insulation, vermiculite. That's the type of insulation that looks kind of like gold, a little flecky gold stuff. That has asbestos. We could talk for about a half an hour on that alone probably. Right. About where it came from in Libby, Montana, and things like that. The state of Wisconsin, on their Department of Health and Safety website, has said vermiculite has asbestos in it. So I'm not going to argue with the state of Wisconsin on that. So
besides asbestos, what other hazardous materials could be
lead
in a
paint?
House?
Lead paint. You know, house built before 78.
What can you do about that, though? There's nothing you can really do about it.
You can do remediation things. The biggest issue is around windows. Okay. So as a window contractor, you guys have to be certified or trained in lead safe practices. If you got lead paint on your wall, I guarantee you my house, 1927.
Yeah, my 1940.
I don't know how many coats of paint are on the wall,
but
the first few will probably have lead paint. While it's covered up with paint, that's not a problem unless you start doing some remodel and banging into the walls. But just general, the wall being there, that's not an issue. But I mentioned windows, old wood windows, especially older houses in the city. The windows are going up and down. The windows, you know, and the little paint comes off. Kids put their hands in the window wells. They put them in your mouth. I've been told that lead paint has a little bit of a sweet taste. Oh, this tastes good. You know, next thing you know, they're eating the chips and everything. So that's where the lead paint issue is. And again, you got to do some testing. The one other thing that some people consider to be a hazardous is mold. And again, we don't inspect for mold. We inspect for high levels of moisture in areas. And when you get too much moisture where it's not supposed to be, you're generally going to have building materials that will grow mold. And so, like I said, if I see something, I say something. But it's always saying, I think this appears to be, you should have this looked at further.
Okay, we're going to take a break over to the WTMJ Breaking News Center. Thanks for listening to the Fix It Show on WTMJ.
If it needs fixing, we can help. It's the Fix It Show on WTMJ.
Thank you for joining us. We know it's the start of gun hunt season if you're looking for your deer, so maybe you got us on an app or a little earbud out listening while you're watching for deer. Thank you for doing that. I know you're going to go hunting and try to get something. So Dayton Kane, David Nason here. Let's talk about when we're going to sell our home,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
What are some things we can do, should do, or shouldn't do. Like there's, right. there's
oh, yeah.
some,
that's a good,
some things
good point.
To think about here,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So let's start with things that we should do.
Right. So as a home inspector, top 10 things, or I got this list from somewhere, but 10 things, to easy things to fix before you have your home inspected. So you're selling, inspection scheduled, you're all nervous. Okay. Check your smoke detectors and CO detectors.
So easy.
Yes.
Make Push sure the button? Yeah. Is it
make
beeping?
Sure, yes. Make sure they're working. We should have at least one smoke detector and one CO detector on every level of the home, not just the basement, not just the second floor if you have a two-story, but one, at least one on each level of the floor and in working condition. They can be combination units. A lot of people, oh, that CO detector needs to be near the floor. Nope. Especially if you have a forced air system in your house, it can be up on the ceiling. Okay. So one of each on every – if they're older than 10 years, even 6 to 10, somewhere in that range, consider replacing the unit. And if you really want to be as close to our standards, is put a smoke detector inside each bedroom.
Yeah,
but like I guess I'm looking at a minimum of one per floor. Second, handrails at stairs. When we have more than three risers,
okay,
one, two, three, we should have a handrail on the wall. A lot of times I see they've been taken off because you're moving furniture or something. Well, put it back because if that's considered a safety hazard. I'm not a code inspector. Our code says that handrail has to be there, but I'm going to call it a safety hazard because it's just a requirement. So, but we don't want people falling down our stairs. We talked a little bit in the first hour about outside work. Clean your gutters. Clean out your guys.
What you're looking for is this home being maintained,
yes,
right? Do
right.
they care? Have they right. taken care of the home?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right.
And
so,
all these things you're mentioning, they're simple,
right.
but it shows, hey, these people weren't doing what they're supposed to
right.
do.
And I, you know, certain times of the year, like right now, you could clean your gutters this yeah. morning, and then you'll have to clean them
Trust
again
me, I know.
Monday.
I did.
You know, or even tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I get it, but at least... Don't let
you don't
them,
have trees growing yeah, out
exactly.
of your gutters.
I was just going to say, leaves may be one thing, but yes, if you got trees growing out or so much debris in them, and yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, oh man, they haven't even touched these.
Yeah.
So, gutters. Along with that, checking your downspout and extensions. You were saying, make sure they're attached. I'm not a fan of the corrugated plastic ones. They end up like turning into snakes.
Yep.
They hold water and everything. I like having an elbow and then a piece of extension that's the same as the aluminum downspout, 4 to 6 feet away from your house. If you buy them, they come in sections 10 feet long, cut them in half. So now you got 5 foot extensions.
Yep.
So that's really about as far as some cases, if you got a really flat yard, maybe you need a little longer one. I get it. But get your extensions attached to the house. GFCIs, ground fault circuit interrupters. Those are the outlets that you see in the kitchen and bathroom with the test and reset button.
Mm-hmm.
It says on the face of that outlet, test monthly. So if you yeah. haven't been doing that, you're in trouble. No, nobody does that, obviously.
Nobody.
I probably do my bathroom one more than a month. I'm just brushing my teeth. I'll reach over and push the button, trip it, reset it. Kitchen, I'll try to do it every couple months or so if I'm just staying in there. The little circuit inside that outlet is there to keep you from getting electrocuted.
Right.
And so these should be in kitchens, bathrooms, laundry areas, garages, outside, unfinished basement areas they're required to be in now. And if you have a house probably built in the 90s, just if you go in your bathroom and you don't see a GFCI there, there's a very high likelihood that there's a GFCI in another bathroom, either the primary bathroom
sure.
or the half bathroom or something. And that GFCI is protecting all the bathroom outlets. Really, the only way to tell is you'd either have to have the tester that I use that tests them, but you could plug a lamp into that bathroom upstairs that has a regular outlet and then go down in the half bath and trip the GFCI. If the lamp goes off, it's protected.
Sure.
So that you can plug something and you can tell that. So testing your GFCI is making sure it works. Replace missing or burnt out light bulbs.
That's easy.
Yes. So you're turning on a light, you're like, do I say anything? Does the light fixture not work? Is it just
right.
a bulb
That's just it.
Kind of thing? I generally don't make a too big of a. Now, if I'm going through the whole house and nothing's turning on, you know, sometimes the house has been empty for a little bit. So, but that's pretty easy to do. Same thing, missing cover plates on switches and outlets. If you painted, put them back.
Yeah.
So now they're on. Change your furnace filter. We tell you that every time with Jason Fox. Yeah. Just make
so
sure you
check.
That is just one of the things where I get down checking the furnace and you pull out the furnace filter and it's a year old and it is just covered in dust or big chunks of dust and things like that. If you got a 4 or 5 inch filter, yeah, 4 to 6 months should be fine. If you have a pet or pets, maybe you need to check it a little more often. If you have a 1 inch filter, 60 days you should be replacing that. That's a regular thing. Every 2 months you should be replacing that filter. Clean your AC condenser. That's the part outside. Just clean all the vegetation away from it and everything. And then lastly, your dryer vent. Just where you can get it. Maybe you're not taking the time to disassemble the whole thing, but go outside and look at the louver thing outside. Is there so much lint on it that the flapper is staying stuck open?
Yeah.
Clean it all out. Again, what you said, it makes it look like you're taking care of your home.
That's the main thing. Are you maintaining the home? Because everything takes maintenance. Okay, when we come back, things you shouldn't do before an inspection. We'll hit that. It is the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
We can't help fix your relationship, but we can help with that leak. It's the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
We're back. Thank you for tuning in to WTMJ. Dayton Kane, David Nason. We talked about things you should do before a home inspection gets done on your home if you're going to sell. But there are also some things that you shouldn't do because it's kind of a red flag to the inspector when he comes in. You're an inspector.
Yeah.
When you go in, David Nason, if you see certain things, what is it? What does it send up as a flare? Well,
the number one that we talk about is don't paint your basement walls.
Not right
your,
like
your foundation
not
walls.
Right before you're going to sell, don't do that.
No. If it's a couple years before you're going to sell, I mean, yes, go ahead, but yes, literally weeks, months, a month or two before you're going to sell, that is absolutely to me a red flag. Like, how come they painted the walls here? What are they trying to hide? So we want to make sure that we can actually see. I would much rather see some stains on the walls here and there because in my mind, some stains on the walls, not the biggest deal. If we have movement in the walls, that's a totally different thing.
Right,
but if
right.
we see some stains, that is almost always related to a drainage problem. It's like, okay, we got to fix the drainage. Fine.
Well,
but
these
if you're
houses...
painting over it, it's like, now the question is, like, what else is there that
I would assume most houses, like Milwaukee's got a Shorewood, Bay, all those places. My house was built in 1940. When you have those block basements, they probably have had water in them over the last 100 years, right?
Right.
Or 80
exactly.
years. So
exactly.
It's not crazy to expect that to be there.
And don't this is a double negative, I think. Don't not disclose things.
Right.
I mean, don't go crazy. Okay, we you know replace the screen on the window in our dining room. Okay, you don't have to disclose things like that. But you're right. If you had some water in the basement, tell us.
Yep.
You know, don't hide the fact. What's worse, you telling me, and I was like, okay, we had a flood, of course. Or you say, no, we didn't have any water. And then I go down and I see all the stains on the – not necessarily always on the walls, the foundation walls, but what about all the walls underneath your basement stair? I see stains there or on the door jams of things. And I'm like, there was water down here.
Yeah.
How come they didn't disclose that? So be honest, but you don't have to go overboard. But tell about the major things in your
A lot of basements actually have lines chiseled into the floor to get the water to go to the drain.
Exact, older basements.
It's part of having a basement in Wisconsin.
Years ago, like you said, those old houses, people just expected that you'd have a little bit of seepage.
Yep.
A lot of homes, a lot of old homes didn't have gutters on them.
Yeah.
That, you know, the old Victorian homes with the trim on them and things. So don't do that. But I also wanted to say, if you are shopping for a home, some things that you should really look for, and one of them is a basement water problem. So we kind of touched on that. You know, are there a lot of stains? If you get that ring around the stain, that could be a drain tile issue. But bigger major roof issues, just stand back from the house and either bring a pair of binoculars, whatever, your phone, zoom in on your phone. Is there, if it looks like there's a problem with the roof, maybe there is. You know, I mean, you're not a roof expert. You're not climbing up there. But a lot of times you can
see
shingles missing.
One of the easy things
missing
is you see the swoop in the roof.
Yeah,
that means
that
the rafters,
there's
something going on.
Right, right. Same thing up on the roof, the chimney. Look at the chimney, especially if it's a masonry chimney. If it's all stained and everything, water is getting in that chimney most likely. So look to see if you have any problems with the chimney. Decks can be a problem. How is it built? If you can see under it at all, are there joist hangers? How is it attached to the house? It's supposed to have bolts or these special screws and things. So, but you know, is it wobbly? You know, are the railings wobbly? Do the railings have really wide openings? Things that you can very easily see without having to necessarily be an inspector. And then check to see if you can find the age on appliances. Furnaces, if it looks like it's an old furnace, it probably is.
Right.
But some of the furnaces are – there's furnaces, it's usually inside the cabinet, so you're probably not taking that apart. A water heater, the age is right on the label there where it says how many gallons it is. Most of them are saying manufactured date, but most of them are in the serial number.
I have a list, ongoing list of everything I do to my house, mm-hmm. who did it. If I didn't do it myself, what it cost, you know, so that when I do go to sell, I'm not planning on selling anytime soon, and those things may get updated. I may have another water heater down the road that is going to replace the one that I have there, but at least I can then go when I sell my house and go, here's everything that's been done, when it's done, who did it, so that
every once in a while I see that list, which is really nice. And I know that I'm going to find all those dates on those, but I can,
shows maintenance. It shows you're caring for the home.
I might find a date on the furnace, but it was installed. So I'll actually say it was manufactured in 2023, but it was installed in 2024.
Sure.
Because if I find a date on it and they say, well, no, it was installed in 24, because they don't want it to sound like it was older than it actually was as well. There's a difference between a manufactured date and install date.
All right. We do need to take another break. It is the Fix-It Show on WTMJ. Thank you for listening.
Making it a great Fix-It day. It's the Fix-It Show on WTMJ.
Made it through almost 2 hours. A final segment here on the Fix-It Show, sponsored by Siding Unlimited and J&B Construction. We thank them every week for doing that for us. It's it. You're going. You're leaving here. You're going to go try to find your doe or your buck. Can you get either?
Yes.
Can you get both?
Yes, you can.
You can? Yeah. Really?
Well, it depends on the county that you're hunting in.
Have you gotten both?
Yes.
You have?
2 years ago, I got a small buck.
Well, good luck. Hopefully you can get two again.
Right.
What do you do with all that meat? I've never seen a venison stick.
Right. maybe I'll have to do that. I do share. I go up near Wausau with my family, and we butcher our deer right away.
Oh. You do it yourself?
The main butchering, yes.
Really?
Okay. And then we skin it. So if I shoot a deer today, we skin it tonight, hangs overnight, and then butcher it up tomorrow. Wow. I come home with my deer in a cooler.
Interesting.
Instead of on the
I don't know a lot of guys that do that anymore. They bring the deer in and have it done.
So, and then I'll have some of the meats, kind of the trimmings that we call it, and I'll take that somewhere to have sausage made and the sticks and things like that, but all the steaks and chops and everything else that just gets all wrapped up for the freezer. The tenderloins or the back straps, those we don't even freeze. Those we're cooking right away.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that's just
all right. Well, good luck. Hopefully you get yours.
Thank you.
Then Thanksgiving, anything planned for that?
Getting together with family. Go to my sister's. We'll all get together for Thanksgiving. Then we go to a friend's house for Friendsgiving.
Okay.
After that, how about you?
Everybody's coming to our house. We got a big old thing. And we just did this last weekend. We did a kraut knuckle night where we had everybody over, German thing. You never had kraut knuckles?
No.
Oh, it's basically cabbage and noodles. And anyway, good stuff. And now we're hosting again for Thanksgiving. So it's been nice. I had to keep the house clean. So okay. So then next week, we're going to do this all over again, 7 to 9
we'll
every
back.
Saturday. We do the Fix-It Show.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if we have any guests next week. Didn't have any this week. So
I
think we filled it well. Hopefully people are
email.
Informed and ready to go. So enjoy your week.
Thanks. You too.
And
it'll be a short one, but we'll be back.